Welcome to the AJP Heart and Sarc podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss a new guidelines in cardiovascular research article by Usselman et al. Titled Guidelines on the Use of Sex and Gender in Cardiovascular Research. This article was published December 21st, 2023. Joining us today are host and author, Dr. Christy DeLeon-Pinnell, and authors Dr. Charlotte Usselman, Dr. Austin Robinson, Dr. Judy Regensteiner, Dr. Carrie Moreau, Dr. Quinn Denfeld, and Dr. Jesse Morera-Bouchard. Let's get started. Christy?
Thank you, Kara. Until more recently, the effects of sex and gender have been ignored in research design and reporting. This has resulted in basic and clinical research where women and gender diverse individuals have been excluded, leading to a lack of understanding regarding sex and gender in cardiovascular health and disease. The goal of the recent guidelines article published in AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology was to provide advice on best practices to include sex and gender considerations in study design, as well as data collection, analysis, and interpretation. Charlotte, you served as one of the corresponding authors for this significant undertaking. How did the idea for providing guidelines to help researchers with incorporating sex and gender when designing and executing research plans come about?
The honest answer is that you and Mary Lindsay asked me, Christy, and when Mary Lindsay and Christy ask you a question, you say yes. So I started by being really honored, and then I started thinking about what a paper like this would look like, and I started freaking out. And I think for me, what you said about women and gender diverse people being underrepresented, in talking to my colleagues, I think that a large hesitation on behalf of a lot of well-meaning researchers is that they don't know how to properly address sex and gender. And that sort of results in an analysis paralysis where they just don't get into it. And I've talked to so many well-meaning colleagues for whom that's the case. So when we were thinking about doing this paper, I think the real vibe was like, let's try to make this simple, or as simple as possible. And, we started with, let's keep it simple. This is not complicated. And then, there were a lot of moments of, well, actually, it is kind of complicated in some ways. So we really tried to, I think, hit the balance between making this an easy guide for people who have been intimidated to get into sex and gender research and to give them a place to start. And then for those people who have made this the focus of the research programs to give more advanced recommendations, and for people who are really probing sex and gender differences, how to do so. I think there's still a long ways to go on especially the gender side of things, but that was really the impetus. And I think you can see that in how the paper breaks down. We wanted to cover, okay, study design, data collection, analysis, reporting, and interpretation, and address everything from beginning to end. And where there's more evidence to guide that, we provided more guidelines. And where there is less evidence, I think the guidelines are sort of reflect that. So I think that these guidelines personally, and I've heard from a few colleagues already to say they're a very nice introduction and good starting place for people who are getting into that. And that makes me happy because I think that was our ultimate goal.
Thank you, Charlotte. And I can promise you, Mary and I are very appreciative that you took on this role because it is quite the undertaking. So Carrie, while all the recommendations are super informative and important, what would you say are the top 2 to 3 recommendations?
Yeah, hi, Christy. Thanks for that question. I would say the top recommendation is to include both men and women in your studies unless you can scientifically justify for not doing so. And that it's not enough to say, well, I don't have the sample size to do it, but you don't have to. I think we have to get away from this thinking that it's still not going to be informative by excluding one sex without the other. You can do secondary analysis on the data when you report it to see if there's like a signal there in one sex or the other that is driving the response. And we can see this in, for example, in response to interventions. My colleagues up at CU Boulder did an exercise training study back in the day, and they collapsed their men and women into one group The response wasn't as robust as what we would see, but it was still st statistically significant because they had a large sample size. But when they separated out by sex, it was the men that was driving that response, and we didn't see the same. We saw like no response in the women. So it just kind of shows like you could bury some significant findings and then generate these guidelines for interventions or treatments that would, assuming that it affects both sexes the same way when it doesn't. The other top recommendation that I would say is just on reporting the data, showing the data by sex, whether it be by different colors. It's not enough just to have it that you have equal numbers in both your treatment groups or both your control or your disease group. I think showing the data by sex is also just as informative. And then my third recommendation, one that kind of I thought was kind of opened my eye, and I was brought to this discussion through Dr. Ulseman. Tell me about gender, not just gender identity, but these gender roles, gender construct, gender relations that could be influencing your data. And I know this is still like an evolving topic of how to present these data and how to analyze the data, but I think we have to start somewhere, and we probably will see the significance of the effects of gender on a lot of our findings that are yet to come. So those would be my top 2 to 3.
Thank you. Those are all very, very good recommendations. I agree with all of those. And so, Judy, you have served as a mentor for many young scientists aiming to close the gap in knowledge about women's health and sex difference research. What do you hope young readers will gain after reading these guidelines?
I think these guidelines are more important than we even know today, because for a young person who wants to get into the field of sex differences, gender differences, women's health, or any of those areas, there's not a really strong curriculum to guide the field. And we're working on such a curriculum at the Ludeman Center. But what all young people need to know is how to do this. It's so confusing to people, like Carrie Moreau just alluded to, that people don't know how to embark on studies that include sex and gender. And we have to know how to do that and be able to teach it to our mentees so that they too can embark on it. Because a lot of people do say, well, it's going to cost me double to double my sample. And, of course, that may or may not be true. But there needed to be a primer, if you will, to get people started. And we need to stop letting people off the hook in terms of, well, should I study both sexes or not? I mean, journal editors have to get involved, funders all have to get involved, and some have, and mentors have to get involved. Everybody has to focus in on this effort so that it's not the norm anymore to just say, well, if you can only study men, that's fine. Cisgender men who weigh 70 kilograms, you can't have that. We have to make it, but we have to make it doable. We can't just say, go do this. We have to show people how to do it.
I love that. That's a good way to kind of approach it. You know, we can't just expect people just to go do something without anything, without any guidelines, without any hints on how they can approach it. So Jesse and Austin, reflecting upon tables 1 and 2 and the recommendation provided for optimal study design, data analysis when evaluating effects of sex and gender, what are the most often forgotten by investigators that the field needs to double down on? And we will start with you, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think in my experience, particularly with human participants research, people often forget to include gender, right? There's this conflation of sex and gender that I think the field isn't very clear on. And I don't think that until very recently it's become very publicly known that you have to be clear on the difference between the two, but I think that's led to a lot of confusion and a lot of people will say sex when they mean gender, when it's self-reported data, or they never took both of those variables. And so for me, it's such a simple effort to just implement more comprehensive demographic taking when you enroll study participants that right there alone can just capture elements that are making your study design better, make your data analysis plan better because you have sex and gender. And so for the human one, that's what I think. And then I've seen a lot of animal studies on the other side, so table 2, that kind of have both sexes involved. They've got the male mice, the female mice, but then there's lots of lumping, and they just assume there's not going to be a difference, or they assume because they've controlled for the estrus cycle that they've eliminated the need to analyze the sexes separately, so there's no difference. And for me, it's like, well, why don't you bother looking anyways? just that assumption right there is going to deprive the field of data that could have been analyzed. I think those are, for me, the big two.
Yeah, I focused more on table one with the human studies, but to follow up on Jesse, I think that was a great point. You do see a lot of papers that still conflate sex and gender, so making sure to be clear about that in the language throughout the paper, and especially in the methods, just to set the tone for the rest of the paper, I think would be great. Another thing that we noted in both of the tables was a power analysis. So just in general, sometimes you'll note that papers are missing a power analysis. So just stating if there was a power analysis, or if it was more of a kind of secondary question from a different original question in the study would be great. And then also clarifying if the study was powered for sex or gender differences, or if you're making those comparisons on more of a preliminary basis. And I think another point that Carrie mentioned, and in a previous podcast with Judy and Quinn, we had mentioned it's really important to use different shades or different symbols for the different genders or different sexes when you're presenting the data. That way, even if you're not interested in a sex comparison per se or gender comparison, future researchers could use that individual data to calculate effect sizes for their own future studies that might be interested in those differences. And then another thing that we mentioned in table one was to report whether or not participants were on contraception, and then if they were, to provide some details about that, such as what sorts of contraception they're on and how long they've been on them as well. And then lastly, this was something that was kind of a learning process for me as we were writing the papers. I think a lot of investigators should at least report pregnancies and or births in the method section when describing their participants at some point.
Those are all very good points. So Quinn, and writing guideline papers such as this is obviously a tremendous effort. And so thank you to all of y'all for putting so much work into this. What was the hardest part about writing this up? And any advice for anyone who's thinking of putting something like this together and how they should maybe approach it?
Yes, thank you for that question. And I also look forward to hearing from my colleagues about this as well. But I view guidelines papers as the ultimate group project, which for our listeners may invoke memories from high school or university of very challenging moments in learning. And so group projects are difficult because people have different writing styles. They have different approaches to writing. Some get things done right away. Some are last minute by nature. And people have different perspectives as well. So in addition to wrangling the science, which is what you have to do for guidelines papers, you also have to wrangle people, which can be difficult in order to generate a consensus statement that incorporates everybody's perspectives. But on the flip side of that, there is a lot of positives to it. It's, first of all, such a great learning experience, and it can be very fun, as evidenced by getting to meet all of you, work with new people in the field and other people that I worked with previously. It's also was an honor to work with such prolific leaders in the field. So as an early to now mid-career individual researcher, it's been really such a wonderful learning experience to work with these leaders. And putting together guidelines papers is a way to benchmark where we are in the field, and they're meant to be revised in the future. So it's great to be part of where we are in 2024 to see where are we at in the science and then get to see that evolve after that. So advice, I guess I would say that pick your people for your group carefully for your group project. That would be one, but we have so many wonderful people in this field that there's a lot of people to pick from. And then two, give yourself extra time. Inevitably, I don't think I've ever seen a guidelines paper that has met the deadline right away. There's always going to need to be extra time. And then have fun. Enjoy it. Enjoy getting to dive into the science, learn from new people. It'll advance your own research as well. So those are my bits and pieces of advice.
And I think something that what you said highlights is, you know, in order to do something like this, you have to have a good leader, right? And so, Charlotte, thank you for handling all of us and being our handler and during this whole process. Does anyone else want to add something?
I want to jump in to say, number one, I feel like, Quinn, what you said was perfect. And Thank you, Christy, for calling me a leader. I feel like I was like most of the time an overwhelmed leader, and it was really helpful to have Christy and Mary being like, let's get it out. I think these guidelines would have come out in 3 years if I would have had my way, because I kept on thinking, but what about gender? Like, we don't have enough here and we don't have enough there. And I really appreciate what everyone's saying about the importance of these guidelines and helping people move forward. And I think when we're talking about all of the things that we're recommending, my sense in talking to people who want to get in this field or who are reluctant to sort of include women or incorporate gender, you know, you're not going to the penalty box for what's been done in the past. And I think if you were to read my papers, we talk about sex in a way that I think is probably in hindsight gender, or at very least both. And I think these guidelines reflect less where we are as a field right now and more where we as cardiovascular researchers would like the field to be. And so this is sort of all of us, our group project, coming together and saying, based on the data we've seen, based on the variability, the outliers, the interesting findings, what would we like to see in our colleagues' papers and in our own papers? And I wish I had assessed gender and sex separately in all of my participants over the last 6 years. Again, no one's, this is a real hockey Canadian reference, no one's taking me to the penalty box for not doing it, but what we're saying is that's okay. So now in your next studies, assess this. And I mean, that's what we're doing. So I think, you know, not having done these things in the past is no reason to bury your head in the sand. I think these guidelines are there to say, look, there's evidence that, you know, pregnancies affect cardiovascular outcomes. There's evidence that gender affects it, that sex affects it. So we're not trying to harass people. We're saying, look at your data, and I think the guidelines and especially the graphical abstract reflect this nicely. Think about how these things might affect your data, and I think it gives you a richer experience when you get to analyze your data to have the components of study design and these variables at your fingertips.
Well, on behalf of AGP Heart and CIRG and the scientific community, I want to thank you all for all of your hard work and efforts on these guidelines. This is not an easy thing to pull off, and we appreciate all of the time and energy that you poured into this effort. Kara, back to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and CIRG podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.